It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Millions rally across France and worldwide over last week's terrorist attacks in Paris. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Millions filled the streets of Paris and other French cities Sunday to show solidarity against last week's terrorist attacks in the French capital that killed 17 people.
Like everyone else, I was deeply shocked on Wednesday. I've been reading Charlie Hebdo on and off for 30 years. It's just a part of life that has been brutally taken away.
It's the first time I'm coming out for an event like this, but it's important to show at the entire world we're not afraid.
I'm only 17 and I've only read about this stuff in history books, and here we are today making history.
More than 40 world leaders joined French President François Hollande in linking arms for a walk through Paris. 12 people were killed Wednesday at the offices of Charlie Hebdo, a satirical magazine. Two Islamic militant brothers, Sharif and Saeed Kouachi, carried out the attack. They were killed by French police Friday. Another terrorist gunman murdered 4 hostages at a kosher supermarket in Paris Friday before being killed by police that stormed the building. 2 explosions ripped through a marketplace in northeastern Nigeria Sunday, the second attack in as many days, using young girls strapped with explosives. The blast struck within minutes of each other at a crowded mobile phone market in the town of Potiskum in Yobe State. Security officials say at least 5 were killed in the attack, including the 2 bombers. 22 others were wounded. The blast comes a day after a bomb strapped to a girl detonated at a crowded market in the northeast city of Maiduguri, killing at least 19, wounding 20 others. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State, lies in the heartland of an insurgency by the Sunni Muslim militant group Boko Haram. This is VOA News. The latest attacks came a week after Boko Haram militants seized control of the town of Baga in northern Borno State after intense battles with Nigerian soldiers. Officials say the militants have since burned down much of Baga and surrounding villages, prompting thousands to flee to Maiduguri or to islands in Lake Chad. VOA's Ann Look reports.
Baga fisherman Yahya Takakumi spent 4 days running and hiding in the bush after Boko Haram militants seized the town January 3rd. He says, "I have not seen 4 of my children and my elder brother. Some people said they saw my brother near the village of Dabanshata the day after the attack. But I now fear for his life because only God can say the number of persons that were killed in the Dabanshata area." Survivors told VOA that soldiers ran out of ammunition and had to flee for their lives. They said insurgents blocked the roads out of town and then pursued residents fleeing into the bush. Some residents took canoes across Lake Chad or tried to swim. Takakumi says the killing went on for days in surrounding villages. Ann Look, VOA News. Dakar.
Estimates of the number of civilians killed in the past week range from several hundred to up to 2,000. Unknown gunmen shot at a pastor during a church service Sunday in the Kenyan city of Mombasa. The killing believed to have taken place just inside the entrance gate at the Maximum Revival Center in the city's Majengo section. The gunmen have not been identified, but Islamic al-Shabaab militants from neighboring Somalia have attacked targets in Kenya. Lebanese officials say a suicide bomb attack on a cafe in the northern city Tripoli left at least 9 dead, 37 wounded. The attack occurred in a predominantly Alawite neighborhood. Authorities identified the attackers as residents of a nearby Sunni district. Decades of suspicion between the neighborhoods has been fueled by the war in Syria. Authorities in Pakistan say an oil tanker apparently speeding on the wrong side of a road struck a passenger bus head-on early Sunday, killing at least 62 near the southern port city of Karachi, engulfing both vehicles in flames. In Cairo Sunday, more than 170 international and regional health experts gathered to discuss how to prevent Ebola from spreading to the Middle East. Evaluation missions to 18 countries discovered the region is ill-prepared for a similar outbreak as has occurred in West Africa. Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, has approved a new government, the third since he was elected nearly 2 years ago. In his decree late Saturday, Mr. Keita appointed Timon Ubert Koulibaly as defense minister and Mamadou Igor Diarra as economy and finance minister. Thursday, he named Modiba Keita, no relation, as prime minister. The West African country continues to struggle with al-Qaeda-linked insurgents in the north. The changes come ahead of a planned peace talks this month with separatists. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Monday, January 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. UNICEF expresses concern about the increasing use of children in Nigeria's insurgency.
We have seen a new trend of using of girls, women, and now of children as suicide bombers. This is something that is new to this conflict.
Jane Gove is the UNICEF representative for Nigeria. Thousands of Nigerians flee Boko Haram attacks. An increasing number of Somali children are being born with congenital malfunction. And Sudan's President Bashir announces his re-election bid, but the opposition says it will not be there.
We are not taking part in this election. We are actually resisting this election because it has got nothing to do with election. It's just mere waste of time and resources.
Mariam al-Sadiq al-Mahdi is vice president of Sudan's Umma Party, and remembering the Voting Rights Act 50 years later through a movie. Those stories plus Mark Umar's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, has expressed concern about what it calls escalating violence against children in northern Nigeria. UNICEF Executive Director Anthony Lake said in a statement on Sunday that the images from northern Nigeria should be searing the conscience of the world. The statement came after two explosions ripped through a market in northeastern Nigeria on Sunday, killing at least five people, including the two bombers. The attacks were said to be carried out by two women, one of them a girl thought to be 10 years old. Sunday's explosions came after a bomb strapped to a girl believed to be 10 years old also exploded in Maiduguri, killing at least 19 people. Jane Gove is UNICEF Nigeria representative.
You know, the violence has increased in intensity and frequency in the last year, let's say, a couple of months backward. And we have seen a new trend of using of girls, women, and now of children as suicide bombers. This is something that is new to this conflict. So this trend is very worrying to all of us because it's something that is very difficult to find solutions.
Has UNICEF made any attempt to say, look into why these children are being used? I mean, are they volunteering or is somebody is forcing them to do it?
Well, we have not done a scientific study, but what we have seen is that most likely these kids are not aware that they are being used for this, and someone controls the remote, you know, of these things. As I said, this is a new trend, so we have not had a very good, we would follow through a little more often to see how, say, at the age of 10, you're too small to take these things and do it on your own. We do think that these children are being utilized and are victims of this conflict.
As you mentioned, there was a comment that this raises the need to galvanize effective action. What can be done?
One of the issues that we have is children are not in school in many of these areas. So, of course, if children are not in school and not in safe places, then they are more exposed to all of this violence that is happening there. That's why we are working on an initiative that's called Safe School Initiative, to make sure that we are able to get children back into school, because that's part of ensuring that they have a safe and protected place. If we cannot get schools, then we need to work on safe spaces to ensure that children are not being out and exposed to the violence and conflict that's affecting North Nigeria.
Of course, this is happening when yet we do not know what has happened to those 276 girls from Chibok. What has UNICEF been doing just to see what can be done to bring these girls back?
We have been calling for the release of these girls and other girls as advocates to UNICEF and the UN in general, and many member states of the UN has also been calling for the release of these girls. However, the families themselves have not come to UNICEF, but we continue to work in ensuring that other girls. So we came up with a program that the government of Nigeria is doing to provide scholarships for girls that were also in school in those areas where the conflict is very intense, and they have been provided with scholarships to be able to attend other schools. So that is mitigating the effect on other girls.
Jane Gove is UNICEF representative for Nigeria. She was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. The UN Refugee Agency says thousands of refugees are fleeing across borders in the wake of deadly attacks by Boko Haram militants in northeast Nigeria. In Chad alone, UNHCR says about 7,300 refugees have arrived in the past 10 days. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Attacks by Boko Haram in and around the town of Baga over the past week are just the latest vicious onslaughts by this militant group. Hundreds of people reportedly have been killed, and most of the town's inhabitants have been forced to flee. The United Nations Refugee Agency says the more than 7,000 refugees who have crossed into western Chad are staying with local communities in villages. Spokesman Adrian Edwards says the Chadian government has asked for help, and UNHCR and other humanitarian agencies have begun distributing relief items to the refugees.
Chadian authorities visited the area on Thursday. They requested UNHCR help with the relocation of more than 1,000 refugees who are reportedly stranded on Kangala, an island in Lake Chad. The group recently arrived there, fleeing the general insecurity in northeast Nigeria. With the recent influxes, Chad is now hosting more than 10,000 refugees.
Boko Haram, whose name means Western education is a sin, launched a military campaign to establish an Islamic State in 2009. Since then, the militant group has killed thousands of civilians, abducted thousands of children, and reportedly has sold hundreds of girls into slavery. The United Nations estimates nearly 1 million people are internally displaced. UNHCR reports about 135,000 Nigerians have fled to neighboring countries. Around 35,000 have gone to Cameroon. Prior to the recent influxes, Chad had 2,800 refugees. UNHCR says about 100,000 Nigerians have fled to Niger since May 2013. Refugee spokesman Edward says the UNHCR has started to relocate refugees from the Niger border at Gagamari further inland to the Siam Farage camp in Difa region.
So far, 336 refugees have been moved in three convoys since the end of last year. More convoys are planned over the next few days. The refugees are among the thousands of people who fled to the Gagamari area following November's attack on Damasek in Nigeria. Not all refugees are, however, choosing to be relocated away from the border. Some are staying there in the hope that they may be able to return home when the situation calms.
Boko Haram captured Damasak, a town in Nigeria's Borno state, on November 24th. The militants reportedly killed up to 50 people and forced at least 3,000 to flee for their lives to Difa region in Niger. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The National Umar Party of Sudan, the country's largest opposition party, says it will not take part in this year's April 13 presidential election because it will be a waste of the people's resources. Mariam Sadiq al-Mahdi, the daughter of opposition leader Sadiq al-Mahdi, said any election would not be free and fair because the ruling National Congress Party of President Omar al-Bashir controls everything in the country. This comes after President Bashir, in power for 26 years on Sunday, launched his re-election bid. Mariam Sadiq al-Mahdi said the opposition wants the creation of a national unity government before any elections.
We are not taking part in these elections. We are actually resisting this election because it has got nothing to do with election. It's just mere waste of time and resources.
Well, it can be said that President Bashir has taken steps to want to bring about national dialogue. Isn't that a credit for him?
No, he has been calling for this national dialogue for the last 12 months, and it turned out to be just a waste of time because this dialogue did not start up till this moment. And instead, they said the election is a better way of dialoguing between the politicians and the people. So now the dialogue didn't take place, and now they are saying the election is the dialogue, which manifested what we have been saying, that the ruling party has just been trying to distract the attention of Sudanese people by making them busy talking about the dialogue that never took place up till now.
If you do not take part in the election, You are giving President Bashir the go-ahead to continue to rule the country. Why not go and test the waters and see if you can win the election?
Dear James, what is taking place has got nothing to do with elections. There is no such thing of freedom of expression, no freedom of movement, no freedom of organization. Actually, they have changed the constitution by themselves. They have devastated totally all the pillars of a modern state. There is no rule of law. So in such a case, there is already total failure in governance. There is a serious problem of conflict in Sudan. There is a serious economic crisis. So if the renomination of President al-Bashir would solve that, let them go ahead and solve it. What we need in Sudan is not appointing a man who is already under fear and besieged by the indictment of the International Criminal Court. What we need is reconciliation in Sudan to make genuine and just peace that takes place, and through that we can go into interim period after we start transforming the economy.
So what does your party want? What does the president have to do for your party to take part?
We call for a dialogue to settle, because our problem is not only in whom to rule Sudan, but how Sudan to be ruled. For that, we are suggesting a comprehensive constitutional conference to discuss this matter and to have an interim period which is national, which has the same distance from all the political parties. This national interim government in a period of between 2 to 3 years to establish peace in Sudan and to start the economic reform and to implement the basic freedoms and to prepare for fair and free elections to settle the way of governance in Sudan.
Mariam Al-Sadiq Al-Mahdi is the daughter of opposition leader Sadiq Al-Mahdi and first woman vice president of the Umma Party. She was speaking with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Today is Monday, the 12th day of January, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 23 minutes past the hour. Health officials in Somaliland say there is an increase of children who are being born with congenital malfunction. Etna Aiden Ismail, founder and director of the Etna Aiden University Hospital in Hargeisa, says exposure to chemicals such as insecticides and toxic waste may be contributing factors.
We see a lot of congenital malformation in my hospital that concern children that come from different corners of the Horn of Africa. And the congenital malformations that we are seeing, these are problems that the children are born with, and large number of children are born with a spina bifida. That's the protrusion of the spinal cord through their spinal column. It's tumors on their backs. We're seeing a lot of children who are born with hydrocephaly or hydrocephaly. We're seeing a lot of children with congenital malformations of the extremities, the hands and the feet. And I'm asking myself, why is the number of children with congenital malformations increasing? We never saw that many before.
So what's causing this?
We don't know, but that's what we would like the world to help us find out. But some of the possibilities could be that there is an increased use of insecticides. There could be also dumping of toxic waste in the Somali shore. And that, if that is happening, if that is the reason why we're seeing a large number of children born with congenital defects, then this is a matter for the international community and the United Nations and anybody concerned to do something about it to prevent the dumping of toxic waste in our shores. If it is due to the indiscriminate use of fertilizers and insecticides, then this may be due to the lack of knowledge of farmers and those who are using these chemicals.
Etna Aden Ismail is the founder and director of the Etna Aden University Hospital in Hargeisa, Somalia. She was speaking with Harun Maruf of VOA Somali Service. People with type 1 diabetes, usually diagnosed in children and young adults, must take insulin injections and watch their diet to keep their blood sugar levels balanced. Diagnosing the disease usually requires taking blood samples, a frightening experience for many youngsters. Researchers in the United Kingdom say they have developed a simple, non-invasive initial test, which requires only a whiff of the patient's breath. Viewers George Putish reports.
It is estimated that each year as many as 80,000 children develop type 1 diabetes. The autoimmune disease can be lethal if untreated, so early discovery is of ultimate importance. One of the side effects of diabetes is sweet-smelling breath. Oxford University Emeritus Professor of Chemistry Gus Hancock says it is due to the buildup of chemicals called ketones in the patient's blood.
The sweet smell is this particular ketone which is given out. It's called acetone. And doctors have regularly smelt acetone on the breath of patients who are in the state of diabetic ketoacidosis and used it as a diagnostic.
British researchers say they have developed a portable breath analyzer that can detect even a very small amount of acetone in the patient's breath. CEO of Oxford Medical Diagnostics, Ian Campbell, says it was not an easy task because breath contains molecules of millions of compounds, while this test requires detecting only one of them.
What we do is we allow a subject to blow into the device, we extract out the volatile organic compounds we wish to measure, in this case acetone. The remainder of the breath passes through the device. We then release the molecule that we're interested in into the cavity to make the measurement.
Professor Hancock, who collaborated in development of the device, says similar analyzers exist but only as desktop-sized heavy boxes.
The aim that we have is to get this into a handheld device here that somebody can pick up and use by blowing simply through a mouthpiece.
Researchers say the new analyzer should be ready for doctors' offices within a year, while even smaller versions for individual use may be available later. But they point out the breath analyzer should be seen only as a first screening and a diagnosis must be confirmed by a proper blood test. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
In March 1965, 600 people, led by U.S. civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., set out from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, in a nonviolent march for free and fair voting rights. State troopers attacked the protesters at the edge of the city. The violence galvanized the voting rights activists. A few weeks later, U.S. President Lyndon Johnson introduced the Voting Rights Act in a televised address to Congress. The legislation guaranteed the right to vote regardless of race or ethnicity. On March 25, another march, this time with some 25,000 people, successfully completed the 80-kilometer distance from Selma to the steps of the Capitol in Montgomery. Filmmaker Alva DuVernay interprets these events in her epic drama, Selma. Viewers Penelope Paulu has more.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union.
How many county judges in Alabama?
67.
Name them.
The docudrama Selma opens at the registrar's office in Selma, Alabama, where civil rights activist Annie Lee Cooper is trying in vain to register to vote. From that moment on, the film takes the audience on a roller coaster ride through the events that led up to the Selma marches in March 1965.
You march those people into rural Alabama, unprotected, it's going to be open season.
And propose new legislation.
Selma, by filmmaker Ava DuVernay, also interprets a complex relationship between American President Lyndon Johnson and the leader of the civil rights movement, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
We must stand up. We must make a massive demonstration of our moral certainty.
Ava DuVernay's interpretation of a reluctant President Johnson has drawn criticism by Johnson loyalists.
Cannot wait. You've got one big issue. I got 101.
But the filmmaker says the story is about much more than just Lyndon Johnson. She says it's a celebration of people who did something amazing, and it was a big challenge for the actors.
As long as I am unable to exercise my constitutional right to vote, I do not have command of my own life. I cannot determine my own destiny, for it is determined for me by people who would rather see me suffer than succeed.
David Oyelowo interprets Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
You can't play an icon. You can't play a historical figure. You can play a man, and that I know how.
We apologize for the interruption, and here's now Sports Time with Mark Ulmer in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with handball. Hosts Tunisia and Russia drew 24-all in a friendly handball encounter in Tunis on Sunday. Early on Saturday, Tunisia edged Russia 34-31 in the first friendly in Hammamet. Both teams are set for the World Men's Handball Championships due to start in Doha, Qatar later this week. In athletics, Kenya's world cross-country champion Japheth Korir was runner-up in the men's 4 kilometers at the Great Edinburgh Cross-Country Meet in Scotland on Sunday. The race was won by American defending champion Gareth Heath. In football news, striker Salomon Kalou scored in the 84th minute to lift Ivory Coast to a 1-0 win over African champions Nigeria in Dubai United Arab Emirates on Sunday. In other Orange Africa Cup of Nations build-up matches, Algeria held their hosts Tunisia to a 1-1 draw in Rades. On Saturday, Cameroon and South Africa drew 1-1 in Libreville, Gabon. Burkina Faso outclassed Swaziland 5-1 in Bombela, South Africa. Cape Verde Islands edged Republic of Congo 3-2 in Dakar, Senegal. While on Friday, Senegal pipped Gabon 1-0 in Rabat, Morocco. Turning to tennis, Rwanda is to organize an annual international tennis tournament in honor of the late tennis player Jean-Claude Gasigwa. The Rwanda Sports and Culture Minister Joseph Habineza told mourners at Gasigwa's funeral in Kigali on Saturday. A former Kenya Open tennis champion, Gasigwa was Rwanda's top tennis player. He collapsed and died suddenly while training in Kigali last Thursday. On a happier note, Nigeria National Sports Commission Director General Benga Elegbeleye has assured Haruna Quadri of their support as he seeks to excel at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Quadri recently bagged 2 accolades at the International Table Tennis Federation ITTF Star Awards ceremony in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Placed 30th on the ITTF rankings, Quadri is the highest-ranked African in the history of the sport. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, January 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. I'm James Botti in Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight, comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com.